Today is Friday, July 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. A new warning about Russian cyber operations.
And while this is not new, it's persistent, and they see it right now as increasing.
Plus, protests in the streets of Iraq as temperatures soar.
Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV reports that Tehran is demanding $4 billion in unpaid bills from Iraq to resume service on the four lines.
And exploring California's famous Alcatraz Island. We'll have these stories and more next. On Thursday, a joint advisory released by the U.S. National Security Agency, the Department of Homeland Security, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and the British National Cybersecurity Center warned that Russia's military spy agency was using virtual private networks, or VPNs, to conduct widespread, distributed, and anonymized brute force access attempts against hundreds of government and private sector targets. Joining us is VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden to explain what this all means.
The advisory that came out today isn't about something that's new, but it's something that, according to the NSA, is becoming more widespread, increasingly dangerous. And that's what they're calling this brute force campaign by Russian military intelligence, where they go out, they find a way to get a hold of email credentials, login credentials, and then even though they don't have the passwords, they just bombard systems, guessing at the passwords until they can get in. And then once they're in, they use a variety of tactics and techniques to get further in and basically mine these critical systems across, whether it's government agencies, including the U.S. Department of Defense, defense contractors, universities, think tanks, political parties, and just get whatever information they can that they want, take it out, and then perhaps use it as a later date as part of a larger campaign that isn't specifically necessarily cyber in nature.
Like you mentioned, you know, this advisory didn't really present anything new in the grand scheme of things, but did they have any takeaways in terms of, you know, ideas of future policies or future methods for companies and organizations, whether they be civilian or governmental, to better protect themselves?
Yeah, the NSA and the other agencies involved in this, along with Britain's National Cybersecurity Center, you know, are trying to highlight that, you know, while this is not new, it's persistent, and they see it right now as increasing. And, you know, the Russians using things that software and services that lots of companies use, like Microsoft and Office and Microsoft Cloud servers, as ways to get in. The fix is not perfect, but the first step, they say, is simply to require multi-factor authentication for anybody trying to get in to a computer system. Instead of just logging in with an email and a password, have a way to verify that user's identity. And by doing that, it makes this a little bit more difficult. It can slow it up and give agencies or organizations time to identify something's going on here and then take additional efforts or additional actions to mitigate the risk, perhaps notify the government agencies in the US, the UK, other European countries that look at what's going on in cyber and get some more help.
One last question. As we've been talking about, the advisories was for, you know, larger companies. Are there any indications within this alert for the average user about security concerns for their personal use?
Security is something that whenever you hear U.S. cybersecurity officials talking, they're talking about just installing, starting with the basics, being smart, being savvy about what happens online, not opening emails or attachments from people or places you know you're not familiar with. So there's a lot of those basic precautions, and in something like this brute force attack, those basic precautions can actually go a long way to preventing catastrophic responses. Taking a step back, what cybersecurity officials keep emphasizing is just to be aware, to be smart, be safe, upgrade your systems, upgrade security. You know, whenever there's an update that comes out with security, Make sure it's installed across all your systems, because this stuff isn't going to stop.
Jeff Selden is VOA's national security correspondent. With poll numbers for pro-Putin political parties sinking ahead of Russia's scheduled fall parliamentary elections, the Kremlin has launched a new campaign strategy, clearing the field of would-be challengers. Charles Maines has that story.
In the months that followed the arrest and sentencing of opposition leader Alexei Navalny earlier this year, Kremlin has turned up the pressure on remaining would-be opponents, real or perceived, ahead of fall parliamentary elections. A court ruled Navalny's anti-corruption foundation extremist in a closed trial in June, a designation that forced its liquidation and effectively bans its members from future political life. Meanwhile, other leading opposition politicians found themselves and family members suddenly facing criminal probes, a move designed to force an end to their campaigns and into exile for now.
Of course, the main reason is parliamentary elections. Of course, the Kremlin wants to do everything possible just to get rid of the strong Kremlin opponents.
Behind the move, say critics, the sinking popularity of the Kremlin's ruling United Russia Party before September parliamentary elections.
The rules changed completely compared to 2019. It is now quite impossible for an independent candidate or even a serious opposition candidate not even to get elected, but sometimes even to get registered.
Hardline forces inside the Kremlin appear eager to avoid a repeat of past election mistakes when violations on voting day led to a surge in street protest. Those who've been placed on a government so-called undesirables list say it's easier for authorities to lock up would-be candidates by any means necessary.
It's simpler to cut everything down to the roots than let the situation develop, because it's unclear what happens next, how society reacts. Why risk that when you can just put people in jail?
Observers say it's evidence of creeping authoritarianism as President Putin enters his third decade in power, backed by controversial constitutional reforms that could keep him in the Kremlin through 2036.
There's always this problem with authoritarian regimes, that what you control today, even more must be controlled tomorrow.
In his recent summit with President Joe Biden in Geneva, Russian leader Vladimir Putin rejected suggestions of a crackdown, saying the laws were targeting those openly supported by Washington.
These are the organization and people that promote U.S. policy on Russia. How should we treat them?
Biden says his administration will continue to press the Kremlin on human rights in Russia. But that's little comfort for barred candidates or their would-be supporters as they enter an election season with choices quickly narrowing at the ballot box. Charles Maines for VOA News, Moscow.
In the United States, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of Arizona measures proponents say are needed to shore up election integrity, but opponents say may disenfranchise some voters. Ed Donahue of the Associated Press reports.
The vote was 6-3. The court reversed a decision by a federal appeals court that said the measures disproportionately affect Black, Hispanic, and Native American voters in violation of a part of the landmark Voting Rights Act. Justice Samuel Alito wrote for the conservative majority, Arizona's interest in the integrity of elections justified the measures, and the changes don't affect minority voters enough to prove a violation of law. In a scathing dissent, Justice Elena Kagan wrote, the court has rewritten in order to weaken a statute that stands as a monument to America's greatness. This will set off new calls by Democrats to pass federal voting rights legislation. Ed Donahue, Washington.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. U.S. President Joe Biden traveled to Florida Thursday. He visited the site of the condominium building that collapsed last week. It has also claimed the lives of at least 18 people, with more than 140 still missing. While meeting with Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and Miami-Dade Mayor Daniela Levine Cava, the president promised to provide whatever support is needed.
The governors and the mayor have been completely open with me after whatever they asked, but I think we've been able to deliver. And I think there's more that we can do, including I think I have the power, and we'll know shortly, to be able to pick up 100% of the costs for the county and the state over the first 30 days.
No one has been rescued from the building since a few hours after its collapse. The president had also the opportunity to meet with the first responders and thank them for their hard work.
We understand. Anybody who's ever needed to, they understand. What you're doing now is just hard as hell. Even psychologically. And I just wanted to say thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Rescue efforts were halted early Thursday morning out of concern of shifting debris that could trigger structural failures and further collapse. Authorities say that they are still holding out hope that they will find survivors. In Washington, House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi on Thursday announced her picks for the newly established Select Committee to investigate the violent January 6th attack on the Capitol building.
Our chairman will be Benny Thompson. He's chair of the Homeland Security Committee, and he negotiated the bipartisan commission, and we thank him for his leadership.
Other Democratic Party members announced include Zoe Lofgren, Adam Schiff, Pete Aguilar, Stephanie Murphy, Jamie Ratzkin, and Elaine Loria. Speaker Pelosi also named one Republican to the Select Committee.
Congresswoman Liz Cheney of the Armed Services Committee has patriotically agreed to serve on the committee.
Representative Kevin McCarthy, the Republican House Minority Leader, criticized Cheney's appointment to the committee, saying that Republicans should appoint Republicans and vice versa.
It would be shocking to me for anybody from a party on the other side to come and want to accept a position Democrat from me, and it'd be shocking to me to have a Republican to go to a Speaker Pelosi, of all people, to accept a committee assignment.
Charges were also filed on Thursday against former President Donald Trump's organization and a top executive. AP correspondent Mike Gracia has the details.
The Trump Organization and its chief financial officer have pleaded not guilty to tax crime charges in New York. Charges against the Trump Organization include conspiracy, grand larceny, and tax fraud. CFO Alan Weisselberg was arraigned one day after a grand jury returned an indictment charging him and the Trump Organization with tax crimes. The 73-year-old Weisselberg has worked for the Trump Company for decades. Former President Donald Trump was not charged. It is the first criminal case arising from a two-year investigation into the Trump Organization by the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. I'm Mike Rossio.
The lawyer for the Trump Organization, Alan Futerfas, spoke to reporters after the indictment.
The allegations in the indictment are just that. They are allegations. They have to be proven. This is these kinds of cases typically are resolved in the civil context. Why? Because the law on compensation, on fringe benefits, is murky. It's difficult. It's complex. You could have experts disagree. So these charges are going to be vigorously contested, and they're going to be vigorously contested by people who are experts in the field and know this law very, very well.
Trump released a statement Thursday calling the indictment a political witch hunt. As daytime temperatures soar above 50 degrees Celsius across much of Iraq, protesters have taken to the streets of several cities to vent anger over power cuts that are disrupting their lives. Iraq's electricity ministry says Iran has stopped supplying electricity on all four lines it supplies to Iraq's grid until a $4 billion payment is made. Edward Uranian is up next.
Iraqi protesters gathered in front of the closed gates of an electricity substation in the city of Kut to decry power cuts that have left them with just several hours of electricity a day amid a heat wave scorching the country. A young man wearing a baseball cap tells Iraqi TV that the situation in Kut has become intolerable. He says that electricity comes for 2 hours a day at a time and is unstable for most of the period. He claims that even the governor of Kut has fled the city and has not come to visit for months. Iraq's electricity minister presented his resignation to Prime Minister Mustafa Kazemi earlier this week. Electricity ministry spokesman Ahmed Musa Abadi told Iraqi TV that there are a number of causes for the electricity cuts, among them Iran's cutting major power lines that supply Iraq's grid.
He says that terrorist attacks on power lines, shortages of fuel to supply power stations, and unfair distribution of power on the grid are major causes of the electricity cuts. Electricity coming from Iran, he adds, was completely severed on all four lines Tehran supplies to Iraq. Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV reports that Tehran is demanding $4 billion in unpaid bills from Iraq to resume service on the four lines. Iraqi media report the country's central bank is unable to pay Iran the money due to U.S. economic sanctions on Iran. VOA could not independently confirm the reports. Muthanna Tamimi, governor of Diyala province, told a press conference that terror attacks are also a major factor in recent power cuts. He says that terrorists have been trying to cut high-tension wires between various parts of Iraq and to blow up electricity pylons to disrupt the lives of Iraqis, especially during the current heat wave. Iraqi analyst Bassem Al-Khazaji told Arab media that it's something of a joke that Iraq produces so much oil and gas and still doesn't have enough electricity. He said that the problem started in 2003 and that Iraqis have been protesting electricity shortages off and on each summer since 2011. Paul Sullivan, a Middle East analyst based in Washington, tells VOA that energy shortages have been more acute in the south of the country this year than in the north.
Southern Iraq is where most of the electricity problems are this year. The north does not rely on Iran as much as the south, and Kurdistan has newer and more efficient plants that are run a lot better.
Electricity, he adds, has been a cause for conflict, dissent, and insurrection for decades. Electricity is vital for the state to function, he stresses, and it is not just for air conditioning, but for lighting, communications, refineries, petrol stations, and most importantly, water treatment and water movement. Edward Uranian for VOA News.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. UN aid agencies warn of a looming humanitarian catastrophe in northern Ethiopia's battle-scarred Tigray region if they are prevented from delivering life-saving assistance to the stricken area. Lisa Schlein takes it from here.
The Ethiopian government's tenuous unilateral ceasefire in Tigray after 8 months of conflict has not got off to a good start. The UN Refugee Agency reports the electrical power and phone networks in its offices in the capital, Mekele, are not functioning, hampering its ability to deliver humanitarian aid. The UN Children's Fund has condemned the pillaging of its video equipment Monday by members of the Ethiopian National Defense Forces, warning 140,000 acutely malnourished children were at risk of dying without urgent nutritional treatment. The World Food Program is demanding full access to Tigray to deliver life-saving food assistance to millions of hungry people. Among them, it says, are 500,000 children, women, and men who face starvation over the coming months. The World Health Organization reports the region's health system has collapsed. WHO spokesman Tarek Jazarevich says WHO can do little to help the beleaguered population because access to the area is extremely limited.
We are obviously concerned about potential for cholera, measles, and malaria outbreaks in the region. In addition, Tigray region is also located in the meningitis belt, and it is at the risk of yellow fever outbreaks. People are also at risk of death from lack of access to health services to treat any other diseases that may have.
Despite the ceasefire, fighting continues in Tigray. Jazarevich says WHO is taking measures to strengthen the security and well-being of its staff. He says efforts to provide essential health care is ongoing where it is possible to do so. However, he adds, what WHO staff can do does not approach the enormity of the needs.
Now, with hospitals that are barely functioning, people being displaced, and the looming famine, the risk of communicable and vaccine-preventable diseases spreading due to the lack of food, clean water, safe shelter, and access to healthcare is very real. And all these factors combined are literally a recipe for larger epidemics.
WHO reports an estimated 3.5 million people are at risk of cholera. It says 6 million people are vulnerable to malaria, especially malnourished children. It says they are at particular risk of dying from this deadly vector-borne disease. An oral cholera vaccine campaign targeting 2 million people, which began on June 12th, was only able to reach 50% of the targeted population. WHO reports this was due to the conflict and difficulty in reaching the region's widely spread population by road. The agency reports attacks on healthcare, the looting and destruction of cold chain, the system used for storing vaccines correctly, and the general dangers posed by the warring parties has had a harmful impact on this life-saving operation. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The U.S. State Department has issued a do not travel advisory Thursday for Eswatini because of civil unrest. The country's acting prime minister said that the military has been called in to restore order after days of protest against the nation's monarch. A curfew is in place between 6 p.m. and 5 a.m. local time, and KM3 International Airport has suspended operations. There are also reports of communication disruptions. While the Delta variant continues spreading across the globe, some countries are relaxing COVID-19 public safety protocols, while other countries are entering lockdowns or restricting travel. Dr. Jarvis Barbosa, assistant director of the Pan-American Health Organization, provides masking guidance as vaccination efforts continue.
Well, we have a very different situation in the countries worldwide. We have countries that are getting more than 50% of their population vaccinated, while other countries are still struggling to get 1% or 2% of their population vaccinated. We have countries that have controlled the transmission, so the transmission is decreasing in a very sustainable way in the last 8 to 10 weeks. While other countries are still facing a very important increase in the number of cases and deaths related to COVID-19. So the recommendation of WHO that we fully agree is that we cannot think that starting the vaccination is equal to let's release all the public health measures. This is not the way that vaccines can work. To get the control of the transmission, we probably will need a vaccination coverage around 70% of the population. So while we are increasing the vaccination, it's very important that all the public health measures that we know are very effective to control the transmission needs to be used. Of course, that a national authority, a local authority can make an assessment about the specific situation in that city, state, province, and to adapt the recommendation. But in general, for every country, it's very important to keep wearing masks, keeping social physical distancing, and avoiding crowded and closed space. Even people that receive the vaccine needs to keep these measures, because no vaccine, and this is not only COVID-19 vaccines, but no vaccine for every disease is 100% effective. So even people vaccinated, if in the city that you live, in the state of you live, in the country that you live, we have a strong community transmission, you need to keep wearing masks.
This recommendation comes as the World Health Organization says the African region is facing a serious third wave of COVID-19 cases driven by variants throughout the continent. In a virtual briefing with reporters on Thursday, WHO Africa Regional Director Machito Moeti said new cases have increased in Africa by an average of 25% for six straight weeks to almost 202,000 in the week ending June 27th, with deaths rising by 15% across 38 African countries to nearly 3,000 in the same period. Johns Hopkins University is now reporting 182.2 million confirmed coronavirus infections, including 3.9 million deaths. The United States remains the global leader in both categories, with 33.6 million overall cases and over 604,000 deaths. And finally, we round out the week by learning about one of America's most famous prisons. That's also a national park.
Hi, I'm Stephen Cody, and I'm a park ranger on Alcatraz Island. Alcatraz history goes back really to the gold rush era of San Francisco. Prior to that, it was an uninhabited barren rock in the middle of San Francisco Bay. There's no water or plants on it. It was a great bird rookery prior to the arrival of the U.S. Army during the gold rush. And they fortified the island in the 1850s as California gained its statehood and more people were rushing out to that area. And very quickly, although no one ever attacked Fort Alcatraz, it became this symbol, really recognizable object because of its location there, right at the mouth of the Golden Gate and right next to this boomtown, San Francisco. So the history of it being a prison goes back as long as its history of being a fort. And in fact, because nobody ever attacked and because the cannon that were used that were on the island during the Civil War were obsolete by the end of the war, it became more of a prison through the end of the 1800s and into the 1900s. So it was a military prison along with being a fort all the way up until the year 1907. Who was incarcerated? It was not only Confederate sympathizers during the Civil War, it was U.S. soldiers who broke rules or committed crimes. And then there were some others as well. Native Americans were held prisoner there during the time of the Indian Wars. And during the First World War, there were First World War conscientious objectors held there in the military prison at Fort Alcatraz. Now, in 1907, the island changed its name from Fort Alcatraz to Pacific Branch U.S. Military Prison Alcatraz Island. And that's when they began construction of that giant concrete prison building at the top of the rock. By the early 1900s, there were more than 500 prisoners held out on the rock. By 1933, the military had decided it was just too expensive. And they turned it over to the Federal Bureau of Prisons, which was looking for the site of a new kind of prison. It was an experiment to take all the prisoners at the other federal prisons who were behaving badly, going against the rules or getting in fights or causing problems or trying to escape, and round them all up and bring them out to Alcatraz. The prototype of what we call today a supermax prison. And so that's where it really began its notoriety. That prison operated from 1934 all the way until 1963 when the Bureau of Prisons came to the military had 30 years earlier. It's just too expensive to operate a prison out on this rock in the middle of San Francisco Bay. But I think the surprising thing for most people is how stunningly beautiful it is out there. Not quite what people expect from an old prison. When they get out there, the views of the bay and the city and the Golden Gate Bridge and the Marin Headlands, the gardens, very well-tended gardens by our volunteers at the gardens through the Conservancy, our nonprofit partner, and the bird colonies. We protect nesting seabirds out on Alcatraz. The snowy egrets and black-crowned night herons and pigeon guillemots. So it's a stunningly beautiful place. I love going out there every day and walking around on the rock.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.